so many ways to say I love you in different languages across the land. You haven't heard them all, so I'll tell you as only a true geek can.
Hello, and welcome to Geek Willy Yo,
the world's best married Christian geek podcast.
I'm Rachel Kessler.
That's Mother Rachel Kessler.
I'm a priest here in the Anglican Diocese of Toronto and a PhD in medieval literature, which makes me a giant nerd.
And I'm Lehman Kessler, and I should probably read a book, even though I work at a bookstore, because I'm a huge nerd.
Yes. And Bilbo is chewing his disgusting blanket over on the other couch, and maybe that will keep him occupied.
That is our hope. That is our perennial hope.
We live in hope.
Yes, we do. It's really sad. I don't read, Rachel.
I know you don't read. I haven't been reading much lately either, but I think that's just, like...
busyness?
Yeah.
And sickness?
And sickness.
I did read the John Green book, though. I finally read The Fault in Our Stars.
I need to read the John Green book. You even got it from the bookstore for me, and then I never read it.
Yeah. I quickly discovered that I am not a teenage girl. I mean... I like John Green's kind of, like, approach on his video site. For those who are unaware, John and Hank Green are the Vlog Brothers. They are delightful, whimsical brothers who go on YouTube and talk back and forth at each other. And John Green also has the added benefit of having gone to Rachel's and my college, Kenyon College. He graduated the year that we went in. So he was class of 2000. So we never actually were there at the same time. But... we did get to see one of his fun videos where he visited Kenyon. I was like, yay, this is nice. This is so much nicer than that awful liberal arts movie.
Yes. So I started getting into him when I got into the Lizzie Bennet Diaries.
Because
Hank Green, one of the Blog Brothers, is also one of the creators of the Lizzie Bennet Diaries.
And I had been sort of intermittently kind of seeing some of their stuff just on Facebook and whatnot.
And then when I got sick a couple weeks ago, I just, like, binge-watched.
That's all you watched?
I know! It was crazy! I watched so much Blog Brothers. Like...
this is why we don't read.
I was sick.
You were sick.
I was legitimately sick, and I just had my laptop, and I just watched, like... there's like 4 years worth of videos.
Yeah.
And I just kept watching them.
It's kind of insane.
And there was a period there when they were vlogging like every single day. And there's just so many.
Did they come up with the vlog every day in April thing? Is that, because that's, I know some of my friends who are doing that.
I feel like that's the sort of thing they would do.
That sounds like Vida.
And I am occasionally forced to recall that their primary fan base is, like, 15-year-old girls.
Yeah.
And I don't know what this says about me, that I find their videos so illuminating and delightful.
Well, they touch on a lot of issues. I mean, I feel like they're not... their vlog videos are not necessarily all
in. No, no.
Lizzie Bennet Diaries and Fault in Our Stars.
I love definitely. The Lizzie Bennet Diaries. Oh, the Lizzie Bennet Diaries is a brilliant commentary on Pride and Prejudice, and it is a wonderful piece of feminist media.
With silly hats?
With silly hats, but despite the... So the Lizzie Bennet Diaries also concluded just before Easter.
So you're out of things to watch now.
So it's very sad. My YouTube existence has just...
your stories.
Yeah, my stories are over. But I've been so busy with, like, post-Easter crazy that I haven't really had time to think about that. But hopefully life will get a little bit saner and I can actually read something myself, because I really miss reading.
Reading's a good time.
Yeah, so, I mean, the Lizzie Bennet Diaries ended about a week ago, and it's just... it is a wonderful piece of feminism, despite the fact that it was created and written by two dudes. The way it presents women and female relationships is really, I just think, very challenging to the status quo.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they take characters who are really ancillary characters in the book, the primary one being Lizzie Bennet's best friend, Charlotte Lucas, and make her into a character with great agency.
Yeah.
And, you know, she just, by the end of the series, she has... because I guess in Pride and Prejudice, Charlotte's act of marrying Mr. Collins is... so if anyone listening there is not familiar with Pride and Prejudice, because I assume that most of the people listening to this are dudes, and there is just... you know, we try to defy gender stereotypes, but Jane Austen is one of those things that just...
Girls love her.
I know. It's... I've just accepted it. But, so Lizzie Bennet has the... is offered a marriage proposal by an odious guy. And really, she should take the proposal. Like, her family's economic... Like economic security really relies on one of the daughters making a semi-decent marriage, which is unlikely because none of them have any dowries.
Yeah.
So she absolutely should marry this guy, and she just can't bring herself to because she has too much self-respect. And then her friend Charlotte, the next day he goes and proposes to her friend Charlotte, who accepts him. And in the book, like, it makes sense in the book. You know, Charlotte is considerably older than Lizzie, so, like, the clock is ticking.
The pressures
for her.
The
pressure is higher. The stakes are higher for her. And it is an act of desperation. And, it becomes a point of conflict in their friendship. And Charlotte kind of makes the marriage work.
Yeah.
By avoiding her husband as much as possible.
Yes.
But she's not happy. And I love in the Lizzie Bennet Diaries, they make that a job offer.
Yeah.
Right? Like, Lizzie, who is facing tremendous student debt and still living at home, gets a really, really lucrative job offer from Ricky Collins and turns it down. And then her friend Charlotte takes it. And what I love about that is that, one, not everything is about...
Marriage,
right? That it, it
well,
takes
it can't
the,
be if it's being
right,
modern.
Exactly. But it takes the context of Austen's novel, and where marriage was the only way women could secure their livelihood, and puts it in a modern context. And
but it's still about security and settling.
Yeah, but what I love is in the Lizzie Bennet Diaries, Charlotte doesn't just make this job work. She actually has enough agency to exert some control over the company.
Okay.
And actually impact change and not just become a cog in this big corporate system.
Now, does that change sort of her role within the fiction?
Absolutely.
Because I imagine in the original, she's sort of the cautionary tale, right? She's for the grace of God goes Elizabeth.
Yeah. And I think just is a somewhat much more conventional. And I think she and Lizzie continue a much deeper friendship than they do in the novel. And it's a much more optimistic take, right? I mean, one thing, several of the reviews that I've seen talking about the Lizzie Bennet Diaries look at the character of Lydia in particular.
Yeah.
Lizzie's younger sister, who in the novel, she's a carefree spirit who in the novel ends up running off with the scoundrel of the book and is finally tracked down and forced into a marriage to salvage some of her dignity. But she never quite has a sense of shame about what she did. And she just never... She's a wholly irredeemable character. She's just selfish and...
Odious.
And what I love is that she actually gets redeemed in the Lizzie Bennet Diaries.
Okay.
So, she gets into this ill-advised relationship with this sketchy guy.
Yeah, with bad consequences.
With bad consequences. And she eventually comes to regret it. But what I love is that she... Every character in the Lizzie Bennet Diaries needs to change, needs to recognize, Lizzie included, and especially, has to recognize, she has to confront her own prejudice and her own snap judgments and how she's put people in boxes. Not just, Mr. Darcy, but everyone in her life, Charlotte, her mother, and Lydia. So while Lydia has some repenting to do, if we want to use religious language, she's not wholly condemned by the narrative.
Okay.
Lizzie has to recognize that, Lydia was dealing throughout much of the early part of the story with her own insecurities and feeling like her older sisters didn't value her and just really wanting to be respected. And it was that insecurity that this, the George Wickham character was able to exploit. And so Lizzie has to recognize that it was part of being a really bad older sister that drove her younger sister did this. So it just, it's a fascinating, fascinating
No, it sounds
way
like
of telling. And, you know, the Darcy, the romantic storyline between Lizzie and Darcy is delightfully executed, and the actors, you know, play it very well. And but the main story is really that between the four main female characters.
Yeah.
Being, you know, Lizzie, Charlotte, Lydia, and Jane, her older sister. And I like even Jane, who is so sweet and so submissive and so perfect in Pride and Prejudice, actually gets a bit more of a backbone and a bit more agency in this as well. So when Bing Lee comes back and apologizes for dumping her and running off without giving any word, she kind of just doesn't take him back.
Right away.
I mean, she, you know, she's willing to give him a second chance, and she wants to give him a second chance, but it's going to be on her terms. And I think that it has its weaknesses at times, and, you know, some of the things were cheesier than others, and it stretched the point of believability and what certain characters would allow themselves to be videotaped doing or would do on camera. But I don't know, it just really, it, I think it did some really, really clever things with an 18th century novel.
And are you planning on supporting this in any particular way, Rachel?
I supported the Kickstarter to get the DVDs.
The Kickstarter, you say?
I did.
That's very nice of you. Well, you've been listening to our Jane Austen fancast. Next week, we're going to be talking about Sense and Sensibilities and Sea Monsters.
Okay, those books never got any funnier than the title. Pride and Prejudice and Zombies sounded really funny, but it never got funnier than the title.
Yeah.
Although it did actually, I'm sorry, I'm talking way too much about Jane Austen, but it did at least give a really good reason why Charlotte would have married Mr. Collins, because she knew that she was turning into a zombie.
Right. You know, the guy eventually went on to write, like, a story of the three wise men where they're, like, ninja assassins,
really?
Called Unholy Knight or something like that?
Like I said, I didn't actually think they were very good. Like, they... The title Pride and Prejudice and Zombies and Sense and Sensibility and Sea Monsters were fine, but it was never quite that good.
I think he also wrote the script for the Dark Shadows movie.
Wow.
But let's now move on to...
Have you been doing anything? I've sort of been rambling about my stuff.
I tried to read a book that was meant for teenage girls.
Oh, that's right.
And I was like, I finished it. I got through it. I'm not a teenage girl. I hope everyone enjoys A Fault in Our Stars, and I hope the movie is very successful among a certain demographic. But despite my collection of Ace of Base songs on my iPod, I am not a teenage girl.
And then we had Easter.
There was a lot of Easter.
There was a lot of Easter and Holy Week, and
it's been a busy time.
Yes.
But we're not covered with disease.
We're not, which is a big step forward from our last podcast.
So we should all sound like ourselves, which is
yes.
Nice. No, what I want to talk about today... it's something we've kind of been referencing for over the last few weeks. And I want to talk about our mutual con experiences.
Right.
Rachel and I have both attended two very different cons and come away with very different experiences that we've sort of discussed off and on. But I kind of wanted to talk about cons and their sort of their weird role in kind of fan life and also outside of fan life. So I'll go ahead and start by talking about the fact that I attended a con, mostly an anime convention in Guelph, Ontario, called Con G. Very clever. And I was there to...
How do we explain Guelph, Ontario to our non-Canadian listeners?
Guelph, Ontario is like the seat of the agri-education, like...
Yeah.
Community. That's what I discovered. Because I would be like, I don't know what a Guelph is. And people would be like, oh, Guelph. Well, that's where blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, oh, wow. You are talking a lot about farms and, and farm tech. And I am starting to kind of glaze over. But no, it's a big college town. And yeah, it's the big agricultural kind of education place. So I don't know, like a Texas A&M? I don't know.
Okay. It's prettier than Texas A&M.
I haven't been. I don't want to get into that fight.
Okay.
But I was there essentially as the plus one for my friend Derek. Now, my friend Derek kind of helped kickstart my Ask Lovecraft series by asking me to be Lovecraft in a series of videos that he does. He does a bunch of review, like review videos, which I've discovered is this huge, weird community of people who tape themselves reviewing just whatever, like movies, TV shows. I found this amazing girl who, like, only reviews Christian culture, like bad Christian movies and VeggieTale episodes.
She was very critical of the Water Buffalo song. It made me sad.
Well, of all the silly songs, it's one of the weaker ones.
But it's the first one!
It's very true.
It was so inspired when I saw it when I was like 13, and I was just like, oh, VeggieTales, thank you for saving me from more Superbook when I'm teaching church school.
Well, see, that's the thing. You know, she's exploring the unfortunate mediocrity in Christian media and sort of, you know, this captive audience. Like what we were talking about in our 90s episode, you know, looking at how these captive audiences are forced to kind of watch things that normally sane people wouldn't have to. But he does mostly kind of sci-fi and like 80s cartoon shows and things like that. And he was doing a whole summer of Lovecraft. The summer of Lovecraft was his little gag. And he was looking at movies and books and things and stuff based on the works of Lovecraft. And he wanted to have Lovecraft in his kitchen to provide color commentary from time to time, which is what I did. And that got me started with this whole, you know, idea of, hey, you know what, I could do a show and I can, you know, have people ask questions and answer them as Lovecraft and, you know, sort of see where that goes. And, you know, 9 months later and I'm popular in Argentina and Denmark.
And you have strange tape marks on our walls from where you hang up your bed curtain.
Hey, that is a very useful sheet for my theatrical endeavors. So I was, we went out to Kanji. I didn't really know what to expect. I got very excited, well, when I did a little research and found out that Rob Paulsen, one of my favorite voice actors, was going to be there. He's the voice of Yakko Warner and Pinky from Pinky and the Brain, and he was the original Raphael in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and now he's Donatello in the new Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Anyway, he's like one of my just favorite voice actors and actors in general. And so I got a chance to see him talk, and I got a chance to talk to him, and that was really fun. And then we gave our panel, and our panel discussion wound up being just a description of Lovecraft and his life and his writing and sort of the, you know, it was sort of a primer to Lovecraft. And that was a lot of fun. I was only there very briefly, but I definitely saw a lot of interesting anime costumes and comic book costumes. Every single person thought I was dressed up as Agent Coulson from the Avengers. Even though I even had a little name tag that said Lovecraft, but that's okay. What was your con experience like?
I mean, weird, right? Yeah. Like, it was Toronto Comic Con, and I think it would have been more... It was so defined by the Next Gen cast.
Yeah.
I think they just spent all of their money on that. And Sean Astin was there, and someone from something I'd never heard of was there.
We could have asked him about his Hosea movie.
If only I'd known. But I would have had to pay $50 to...
Oh, never mind.
I mean, we really didn't go to that much of it. We really just hit, like, that one session because our friend Giselle wanted to see Gates McFadden.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, then walked around the vendors for a while and then went to the evening with the whole
cast.
But I guess what I found interesting about it, it's that kind of collective polarization... thing, how, you know, I'm, as I've mentioned before, I've never been a big Star Trek person, right? Like, I have enough background, like, I've often joked that I understand Star Trek, I don't speak it.
Yes.
Right? Like, I can...
You know, you're an alright tourist.
I can follow the conversations, but I don't, you've been correcting that over the past few months, trying to increase my Star Trek education. But it is not my native tongue.
No.
And I was there.
You were raised in a Star Wars household.
I was raised. I think the first time my brother met your brother.
Yes. And somehow Star Trek came up.
And like, he was so offended by finding out that your brother preferred Star Trek to Star Wars.
We were kind of a multi-faith household.
I know, but you still preferred Star Trek.
Well, it was just around for so much longer.
But it was really funny.
Yeah.
It like offended my brother's sensibilities on a fundamental level.
Yeah, but he like owns Jar Jar action figures, so
Yeah, let's not go down that road.
Didn't he collect those crazy, like, Pepsi cans as well?
He did. I think they finally threw those out. I hope so.
That was a strange ad campaign.
Yeah.
I seem to recall at one point someone, like, in the commercial cracked open the Darth Maul can and shook it. It was like, oh, no, my brains are spilling out everywhere.
I have no memory of that. I do have a memory of being on, like, some big road trip with my family to visit my grandparents or something like that. And my brother had to stop at, like, every exit along the way to go to every Walmart to see if he could get a Mace Windu. Because he was trying to get the full set. It was like, no one should care this much about the Phantom Menace, but I am only 16 years old and do not understand yet how horrible the Phantom Menace actually is.
True enough.
But, so
you had all these Star Trek people.
Yeah. And, like, the two people I was there with, my friend Giselle and her friend, and another friend of hers, like, they grew up on Next Gen. Like, this is their childhood. I mean,
well, Next Gen, of all the Star Treks, I do feel like Next Gen really keys into that, like, nostalgia gene.
Yeah, but for me, I have no nostalgic.
But for those who grew up with it, it really, I think it really clicks into that.
I'm sure. I have that a little bit. If with any Star Trek, more with Deep Space Nine. That's the one that I actually have memories of watching when I was a teenager.
Yeah.
When it was on TV and I had no life and was sitting home alone on Saturday evenings.
Fair enough.
So, that was just something I couldn't. Like, I could not relate to at all. But, I mean, but at the same time, there is something contagious about being in that environment. Yeah. And you get sort of caught up.
Certainly. If it's not too scary.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I speak the language.
Yeah, being surrounded by just lots of anime people was really...
I think I would not have been able to
like, do I mean, that. I was only there for a brief period as well. And it was weird, right? Because we showed up early. Before all the opening stuff. So I was kind of like left to my own devices to kind of meander around, being mistaken for Coulson. But sort of, you know, before anything happened. So there weren't any events going on. It was just kind of folks setting up and vendors starting to like kind of get set up and, you know, people sort of trying to sell tickets to like cons that were coming on later. And just seeing all the weird anime costumes and kind of strange sort of fantasy costumes. And every now and then, like, a superhero. And I'd be like, oh, I sort of recognize that person. Okay. I'm just going to...
But I think what got me... I mean, I've heard a lot of people say that Toronto Comic Con isn't that great. And you really have to go to Fan Expo.
Yeah.
For the Toronto geek scene. And there was something that was a little bit like... People seem to be trying to make it into a really exciting con.
Oh, yeah,
yeah. It just kind of wasn't.
It had a sort of strained feeling.
Yeah, a little bit. And I wonder if that is because it was so focused on, like, it felt more like a Star Trek
convention
than
but it's a not
general,
really
but
yeah.
it's not really it yeah. was like a general geek thing, and I protested by wearing my Farscape shirt.
Oh, fair enough.
And which only one person commented on, but that was worth it. So that was just kind of weird, but it was a lot of fun.
Well, neither of us have had a whole lot of really con experience.
Yeah,
you know?
And I don't really know why that is.
Well, we went to that TIFF, or not TIFF, the we did that too.
Went to Much Ado About Nothing at TIFF, which was the Toronto Geek scene.
Yes, precisely. Like going to see The Hobbit that first night.
I saw more people I knew at the screening of Much Ado About Nothing, the one directed by Joss Whedon,
yes,
than at Toronto Comic Con.
No, but we went to the Art Con, the comic book convention.
Oh, that was
in
really
the library,
because cool.
I was thinking, like, oh, I've never really been to a convention, but we did go to that, and that was a lot of fun, and that was like, that's what finally convinced me that Twitter was this sort of important social media thing, because the night before, and this was, I think TCAF, the Toronto Comic Arts Festival.
Yeah.
Like, the night before, you and our friend Victoria were sort of, like, over, and I had my laptop up, and I was just going on Twitter just for whatever reason. I was bored. And I saw that the guy, Dave Kellett, who draws Sheldon, back when you were reading Sheldon more often, he tweeted, oh, I'm in Toronto for this comic festival. Really excited. And I said, hey, Rachel, there's apparently a comic festival, and the guy, Dave Kellett, that you like, and I like from his podcast and other things, he's going to be in town. Like, and we realized that we were able to go check it out. And we went, and I think it was a lot of fun. I mean, we got to see Kate Beaton.
By the way, non-Canadian listeners, you need to be reading Kate Beaton.
I think Kate Beaton has been been discovered by America.
Has she? Okay.
I think like I hear her mentioned in enough other podcasts and comic podcasts.
Okay.
But if not, harkavagrant.com, you will thank us.
And you'll learn about Canadiana and Saskatchewan and
you learn about all sorts of
Pierre
history.
Trudeau.
And you also learn about Fat Pony.
Yes.
But we got to see her. I got to see Dave Malky, who's a guy who, again, whose podcast I've been listening to and whose comic stuff I've been following. We saw a lot of folks that, you know, A, we didn't expect to see because we didn't know about it. And B, it was very exciting and spontaneous, and it was a free convention.
Yeah.
And there was tons and tons of folks. It was all in a library, so that like the feeling of it was really energetic and fun. So that was, I guess, that was one of my earlier experiences, although I realized I technically attended a convention before that when – So I work for a sort of a large chain bookstore up here, sort of the equivalent of like a Borders or a Barnes & Nobles. And one weekend, they sent me and my Australian manager to a holistic conference where we were selling several copies of The Secret and Celestine Prophecies, and I had to take a long hot shower afterwards. But I remember going and trying to figure out where the food court was because we were in this big convention center, and I started walking around and you see all, you know, there's all these kind of hippie folks with their long hair and their robes and sort of like strange medallions, and I was going downstairs and I was seeing people with long hair and robes, and then I was seeing people with long hair and robes and swords, and then people with swords and elf ears, and suddenly I realized I was in like some sort of strange fantasy convention, and I had accidentally like gate crashed some like anime sci-fi convention, and then I lost brownie points by not buying the Dharma Initiative badge for you that I saw for sale. So that was, I guess, technically my first experience attending a con, even though I was really trying to find Burger King.
Well, as we're talking about this, I mean, I realized that in university, I mean, they're not really cons, but SCA events.
Oh,
back when I was in the SCA,
yeah.
And
see, that's weird because you're like, I mean, because you were attending that sort of as like an active participant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, everyone in, I mean, that's kind of the thing about SC is that everyone is kind of an active.
Yeah. It's not just like a Ren Fair where you've got the folks in costume and the folks who are sort of just touring it in their t-shirts.
No. And I've been to Ren Fairs too.
Blech.
But I think it again is this. It creates this bizarre safe space where you can just let everything hang out.
Yeah.
As it were.
It's a safe space, yeah,
for just being as geeky and fannish and all of the stuff that's not as acceptable.
Yeah.
You know, you can just kind of
Well, there's no one sort of peeking and sort of being, you know, you're within a community. I mean, neither of us have done this nor really had an interest to, but I imagine the sort of the next rabbit hole down would be something akin to a LARP,
exactly.
You know, kind of like a private LARP or something like that.
And I think what's interesting is to look at the ways various geeky celebrities either don't get or wholly embrace the con experience.
Yeah.
I mean, not that I've, again, been to many conventions, but I mean, it was interesting to watch the cast of Next Gen.
Yeah.
And just Jonathan Frakes, maybe not, but but that they all just like they knew how these things worked. They knew how to work the room,
yeah,
as it were, right? Like they understood the con
vibe
panel as a particular performative act, if we want to use that language.
Well, Rob Paulsen was the exact same. Rob Paulsen, like essentially, I mean, I think part of it was, you know, it was a Q&A, so people were asking questions.
Yeah.
I think he had heard all of these questions
Absolutely.
Over and over again, but was able to answer it in this really fresh style. And it was funny because I'd been listening to his podcast prior to going to the convention. And I was hearing him repeat the exact same stuff that he says on his podcast. Obviously, these sort of pat answers that he has programmed in.
So there is, like, on the one hand, you are getting to meet these these people, but there is still that kind of...
They're on.
It is still artificial, right? There is an artificiality to it.
And it has to be. It has to be just exhausting.
Absolutely. Yeah, and so... But you sometimes come across references to other actors who isn't like the actress who played Gabrielle on Xena, isn't she notorious for just hating the con scene and hating
I think there's a lot of folks who sort of do it out of, you know, because there's money to be made and it's a way to kind of get yourself out there, but they sort of resent it in a weird way, and they can be kind of like either passive aggressive or sort of mocking with folks.
Yeah.
And then you have people like, I mean, I think probably one of the most famous individuals who, you know, who is really is a positive con person for having such a small role was Chase Masterson, who's on Deep Space Nine. She's Rom's girlfriend slash wife. She's like the Dabo girl.
Oh, her?
But she did so much con stuff and was really like excited and was really like eager to meet fans that people, and she's not, doesn't hurt that she is an attractive woman, you know, who is, you know, has this sort of sci-fi thing, but she sort of recognized, aha, you know, I can make this sort of count and take this very small role and explode it. And she was really well loved by the fan community. Bruce Campbell was an interesting person to see, not in a con experience, but when I saw him at book signings and he did like a little talk before the screening of a movie. And he's definitely someone who's done all these sort of con stuff. And he's
he's an icon.
Well, but he's developed this very like sort of gruff, aggressive kind of persona, very snarky. You know, people ask questions.
But that's part of his
charm. I think that artifice.
Did he call you a leprechaun?
He called me half a leprechaun. I was wearing a lot of green. But if you hear him talk, he says, you know, I don't understand. People like, you know, will line up for hours and hours to see me, and then they'll get up and they won't know what to say. They won't have anything to say. And I'm like, you know, kid, this is your 30 seconds. You know, this is your, you know, you need to talk. You need to engage. You know, I'm open there. I'm ready for you. And I think, I think some celebrities and some, you know, geek icons understand that and work with it.
Yeah.
And I think others, you know, just do it because it's a thing and it's a way to cash in on your sort of, you know, fame or former fame or what have you. It's going to be very interesting when I go to Necronomicon in Providence. Yes. And I trade on my very limited internet fame. But it's been really...
Yeah, but it's going to be interesting because this goes back... It's these cons are about subcultures, yes, right? And you are going into the belly. I mean, you have discovered a strange, one might say dark, corner of the internet in which your Lovecraft fandom abides. And that's who... So, I mean, it might be a limited internet fame you have, but that is your audience.
No, it's very true. It's my audience. And I think, the support that they've had. I mean, you know, I'm in contact with the guy who's running this convention.
So it's obviously a smaller scale than, you know, Patrick Stewart showing up but what is the experience going into the con from the perspective of not someone who is going at
just as an
solely
attending,
as a fan, but also as someone who, you know, people are fans of you?
Yeah, I have no idea what to expect, you know. I mean, I'm really interested in seeing what happens. You know, if folks, you know, are going to be actually interested in seeing me, or if they're going to think, who's this sort of weird guy? You know, why is he up there? I mean, the con organizers are being really nice. They're giving me the opportunity to do my sort of Ask Lovecraft shtick live. They're going to put me on a panel to talk about like kind of social media and using YouTube and things like that with folks like Mike Davis, who's I've sort of become a friend with. Yeah. It's interesting the way I've sort of become friends with folks, other quote-unquote luminaries or kind of linchpins of the Lovecraft community. A published Lovecraft author just sent me like one of the first drafts of like a short story he's working on. And he was just like, hey, I thought you might be one of the, you know, I'd be one of the first people to read this.
Wow.
You know, and this is a guy who is a, you know, a published author who is, you know, getting a book deal done, who's getting one of his books, like, you know, already has a voice actor lined up for audible.com. You know, like, you know, these are folks who are living and working within this community. And I'm a guy who takes a sort of cheap camera in front of a bed sheet and, you know, spends 5 minutes
kind
doing
of just started
voices.
Doing it on a whim one day.
I find that whimsy is my strength in so many ways, Rachel. It's really provided for so much. It may provide for much of our relationship. So I don't know what to expect, and I'm really excited. I mean, I'm really interested in seeing what happens, because in some way I am going as a fan. You know, I am going to see this world and see folks and meet people that I've met online, and because I think that's a big part of it too, right? Is these folks coming together and linking up who only know each other from forums or from kind of these, you know, podcasts or things like that. So that's going to be a lot of fun. And that reminds me of just, you know, what the sort of research I've done looking into fan and cons and fan community and things like that. Years ago, I read two books that are so mysteries, but their setting is really fascinating.
I've read the first one.
Yes.
I haven't read the second.
This is a McCrum. She wrote Bimbos of the Death Sun and Zombies of the Gene Pool. And they are these really interesting sort of anthropological looks into pre-internet fan culture. Bimbos of the Death Sun is about a murder mystery, a murder that takes place at a fantasy convention, and there's LARPing, and there's like all sorts of like crazy, like, you know, cosplay costume contests, and like I think the cosplay contests like get worked into how the detective figures out who did it. I mean, it's very cheesy, but it really delves into the sort of psychology of why these folks come together, why these communities are so important. You know, it spends a lot of time focusing on the con organizer who works like this sad, he's like a Burger King manager, and he's just, you know, crapped upon every day of his life. And this is the one time a year when he is a king, you know, when he has brought all these people together and he has accomplished something, and he suddenly feels larger because he's tapped into this community. Zombies of the Gene Pool is sort of looking back furthermore into like really early fan community stuff, you know, mimeographed zines, those kind of writing chains, like letter mm-hmm. chains that existed. And that I've really come to learn about in researching Lovecraft. I mean, Lovecraft was part of these sort of amateur writing organizations, and, you know, his letter writing was constant. I mean, that's truly the sort of the, you know, the base of the iceberg. You know, Lovecraft's fiction is this tiny, tiny tip, but the amount of letter writing he did is insane. And he linked up all of these folks. I mean, he was the equivalent of sort of, you know, someone running a forum, you know, or, you know, some kind of webmaster just being like, oh, you should talk to this guy. Oh, you're working on this? Well, you know, here's a publisher that I didn't have much luck with, but maybe you will. And he set a lot of people's careers going just by being this guy willing to write all these letters and recommendations and things like that. But he essentially met his wife at a con. You know, it was these sort of writer groups that would get together. You know, they would come from across, you know, New England or across America, and they would meet once or twice a year and talk about writing and talk about the community. And that's where he met Sonia Green, who would become his wife. And that's where, again, this community began to develop. So, I mean, con culture goes back, you know, to the beginning of genre fiction and, you know, things that would explode into sci-fi, fantasy, horror, what have you.
Well, it's interesting to see how, I mean, just to go back to the panel you're doing at the Lovecraft Con, how social media has worked to create those networks and those relationships as well, even outside of cons.
Yeah.
Today, like, I find it interesting. I mean, I think this is the difference in our personalities. Like, yeah. I find it interesting how many relationships and friendships you struck up with the people who watch your Lovecraft
videos. Yeah.
And, like, I just, you know, you seem to already have so many of those relationships and networks going without, you know, even without the con, and you do the Lovecraft chats on Sunday nights, and
yeah.
And you know, there is a part of me that just kind of, I'm like,
you would find it too exhausting.
I'm like, it's the introvert, right? Like, I mean,
well, again, it's also with this, it's a weird boundary issue, because, you know, a lot of these people that I've befriended either on Facebook or Twitter or things like that, you know, they're fans, but they're also artists, and they're also like working within it.
But that's what I kind of mean, is that you're all collaborating together, and you,
yeah,
and it's really, really interesting. And I think that's fundamentally what the cons are, you know, whether they're things like Toronto Comic Con or the early zine culture, or now connecting through social media, it's that desire for community and that desire for, I think, validation. And
well, the cons, I think they take this kind of like strumming kind of, you know, connection that's from, you know, whether it's from letter writing in the early 20th century, or like weird kind of like zine communities of the mid 20th century, or like now kind of form communities, they suddenly take those communities and highlight them. You know, suddenly you're all in a room together. I mean, I saw that even being at Kanji, where, you know, it was a lot of folks who do these video reviews, suddenly all in the same room together. And these are guys who'd been kind of, you know, Skyping or talking over YouTube, you know, like they had this sort of community. But then when they all got together, there was a very different kind of energy. And suddenly, you know, they were much greater than the sum of their parts, you know? And it was very fascinating to see that kind of energy. And then,
and this is why the church cannot exist on social media.
No,
sorry, just to bring it up.
Yes, the church can't get that highlighted feeling.
Well, no, but I mean, I think one of the things that we talk about fairly often on this podcast is that, I mean, because there are two subcultures that we know quite well, that that relationship between the geeky subculture and the Christian subculture. And I think there is in both that desire for community and that desire for connection and mutual understanding and that need for connection. And you just as this is my professional hat on for the moment, but you know, as we talk more and more about like social media and the church, and you know, I think we can go down very dangerous roads if we start getting into church that is wholly virtual, because we do need those human interactions. Like, there is no replacement for physical community.
Well, it's also interesting because fan community is self-selecting, right? You sort of find the people, you find the interest that you have, and then you find the other people. And when you
and the challenge of the church is that it shouldn't be that.
Well, precisely,
That's the Catholicity of it, that it should be, you know, the place where people from all different walks of life are called to
Despite where you come from.
Yes.
It's much more about that geographic selection.
Exactly.
I mean
that's the old parish model, right? That it's, you know, the church you attend is not based on preference but where you live.
Yeah. And so you don't wind up with these kind of extremes where you've got, you know, the kind of the super crazy, you know, church that believes one thing and that hates the other people over here because they're not all self-selecting. Although I guess you do, the car allows that to exist. Well,
I mean, that's part of the reality of the world, not just with denominations, but even within denominations.
Yeah.
That's
a whole other conversation.
We can write a dissertation on that, but I mean, it is a conversation that we have, in our church all the time. You know, what do we put online? What do we make available through social media? What do we intentionally not make available through social media? Because we want to send a message that, no, you need to be here for this. So like, we have made the fairly controversial decision not to ever put sermons on the website.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
Which has made some members of our, like, whenever we have
big guest
corporation
speaker.
Meeting. It's always like, you know, we should put sermons on the website. And, you know, the administrator and I, who handle most of our communications, we're like, well, no, actually, we have made a conscious decision not to do that, because the sermon is, I mean, there's different schools of thought about this, but, you know, the way we think about it, the sermon is part of the liturgy.
Yeah.
That it is part of an immediate context. It should be directed to a particular congregation. I mean, even the sermon is different at the 9:15 and the 11 o'clock service.
Well,
right?
It's rooted in a specific place and time.
Absolutely. And so to put it online strips it of that.
Well, I mean,
in some way. And I mean, this is just there are plenty of churches who do put their sermons online.
Well, and then there's the other model of that, which takes it to an almost sort of like, I don't know, a degree that I know doesn't appeal to either of us, but is the sort of the satellite model where you've got
absolutely the
you know, the one big mega church doing the sermon, and then every other church kind of turns on their live cast and watches it, and it's sort of, I mean, I think we would uncharitably call it something like mech church, but
the main church that does that in the Toronto area still understands the need for that immediate community, and they have cell churches and house churches are a big part. So it's not enough just to go to the big broadcast satellite service.
Yeah.
You're expected to be part of a home church community as well.
That's good. Well, I know the church I went to did we were on TV. Like, we had like a kind of a local feed to, I mean, I think we were on ABC or something. We were on like a pretty sizable network, but I mean, we were, you know, I would not ever call my preacher a televangelist, but I mean, it was just a live feed, show, for mostly kind of shut-ins or folks who couldn't get out there. I remember my mother ran the phone lines for those, and
it was
sort of a pretty depressing lot.
Yeah, sure.
But now, one thing I did want to ask you about, sort of a con experience that's more of a professional academic con, is your Kalamazoo experience. As I was sort of dredging my mind, thinking of like, what are sort of cons that we've gone to that aren't necessarily fan cons? Like, oh, there's Kalamazoo, where I almost went to college, despite the fact that I never actually visited there.
You just like the name.
I like the name. And okay. I think they, yeah.
So for context, oh, faithful listening audience, Kalamazoo is like the end of term party for the medieval studies world.
Yes.
It's
medieval prom.
Oh, well, no, I'll get to that. But it's like 3,000 medievalists from all over North America who descend on the University of Western Michigan at Kalamazoo. So it's actually different. You were applying to Kalamazoo College.
This is
the
University
of Western Michigan at Kalamazoo.
Fair enough.
I mean, like, okay, so Toronto has one of the biggest medieval studies communities in the world.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's a bit of context for this. But you know it's bad when you're in a car full of people who are all medievalists, and you're crossing the border, and the border agent goes, oh, are you guys going to Kalamazoo? You're like, yeah.
You guys smell like Latin.
But it's like, it is an academic, conference, but it's kind of like, it crosses this line between an academic conference and like...
a toga party?
Yeah, sometimes. And it's sort of like, all the grad students are giving papers so that they can get something on their CV.
Yeah.
But you also know that you need something on your CV that's not just a paper at Kalamazoo.
Okay.
Because it is kind of...
it's like the bare minimum.
Yeah, basically. And there's like so many sessions that you like... no one gets a paper rejected from Kalamazoo.
Okay.
And then like... so there is a legitimate academic side to it. But then there's also mead tasting, and there is the inevitable, like, the works of Tolkien in film and fan fiction. That
yes.
was a panel one time. And, like, there are those, and there, like, there are, you know, different, because there are so many different constituencies going to this convention, there's, like, the University of Toronto reception, and the International Society of Anglo-Saxonist dinner, and the SCA wine and cheese.
Yeah.
And so it's that, like, it's that, like, mixed, it's that ambivalence that medievalist, professional academic medievalists feel about resenting the fantasy nerds who make the rest of the world think that we're all fantasy nerds. On the other hand, there is a tiny little piece inside every medievalist that did kind of get into this because they read The Hobbit when they were 8.
Yeah, I would say that's the tension,
so
right?
It is like this weird tension, and Kalamazoo is like just that
plus booze.
Yeah, tension plus way too much booze. And this culminates in medieval prom on the Saturday evening of the conference, where just imagine a university ballroom that's full of a bunch of nerds from high school who are now between like 25 and 65.
Yes.
Who are like reliving their high school prom and just like watching every respected scholar that you ever read and quoted in your dissertation dancing with their 27-year-old graduate students.
Ah, yes.
Including sometimes your thesis supervisor, who was the most notorious and sketchy one.
Yay!
On the dance floor.
Yay!
Yeah.
Good times.
So there was a reason I never drank with it. So
if only, you know,
I don't know where, why did you want to bring that up just to have me talk about Kalamazoo?
Well, I get it. It's again, you know, we've been talking about kind of nerd conventions and sort of things like that. But I think that, I mean, this is this professional, like right. respected, like, you know, gathering, which again is,
but
is
at the same time is still like, there is this id, like it is yeah. this release of id.
Yes, precisely.
Going on.
Very true. Now, I guess to wrap things up, are there any sort of conventions that you've kind of heard of or read about or seen online that you would want to attend? Kind of all things being equal.
I would like to have gone to the Farscape convention, but they're not doing them anymore.
They don't do those.
You could bring them back,
Rachel.
I could.
You are single-handedly trying to show everyone in Toronto all the Farscape ever. You are... That does seem to be your mission, to spread this like
under
a virus.
My hood.
You are hiding under your hood. That cannot protect you. Anyway, I'm just saying, Rachel, at this rate, you can organize, you know, Farscape Con 2014.
Yeah. I don't don't know. I mean, like, it would be awesome to go to San Diego Comic-Con, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the only problem with San Diego Comic-Con is that, like, it's been taken over by everything. So things that aren't...
No, well, yeah, it's
legitimately
become,
geeky. Just
it's become it's, this is where we're going to show the major trailers. Yeah. This is where like the next big video game is going to be introduced. Like it's yeah, it's become the money con.
Yeah, but it would be, you know, that would be awesome.
That would be a crazy experience. I would really like to attend a Max Fun Con at some point.
Oh yeah, that would be awesome.
So I'm a huge podcast junkie, and one of the podcast networks that Rachel and I support is the Maximum Fun Network, which are in their pledge drive week right now, and we've been supporting them for a couple years now, and we're very happy. We have a nice my brother and me tote bag that I got out of it, but they have a regular one out in California, and it's sort of nerd summer camp, you know, but it's like comedy nerd summer camp. So they have like, you know, improv like classes and, you know, ridiculous live shows and stand up and things like that. They did have a Poconos. They did like Max FunCon East, I think last year, and they met in the Poconos. This year, as opposed to doing that, they're having boatparty.biz.
Oh yeah.
And doing their giant cruise, their
that's
weird
crazy money.
Yeah, that's not going to be happening. But Max FunCon would be one I'd like to attend. I know you've told me that I need to attend VidCon at some point.
You do need to go to VidCon
and take Lovecraft to VidCon.
You're a
VidCon.
Legitimate YouTube person.
I am
personality.
I am popular on the Isle of Man. I think I have one view from there. But PAX is something that I'm interested in just because that's the Penny Arcade Expo. It's run by the Penny Arcade comic guys, and I'm very fascinated in it because from everything I've heard, it's one of the most just well-run cons. I mean, cons are kind of organized insanity and chaos, but this, which is sort of nominally a sort of a web comic convention, but not really. It's mostly been kind of a video game convention, but now it's also become like a huge role-playing and board game convention as well. Like, it's just become all of these different kind of fan cultures that I'm a part of.
Here is the difference between us, is that when you asked me about cons, I was like, I guess I could go to a con. I could think of a con to go to. And then you have, like, all these cons you want to go to. And I'm just like, but those would involve meeting people and well, talking to them.
Well, that's a convention, Rachel.
Why would I do that when I can stay at home?
I don't think you're going to find an introvert con.
That would be the best.
What would
that would be awesome.
You guys would just sit in a room
we
with your blankets
and
read
books. I know that would be awesome.
You could
That'd
have
be the best
showing of TV shows that you watch quietly.
I know that just sounds awesome. The best thing ever.
Well, there you go, Rachel. You can organize introvert / Farscape Con 2014. Toronto's best. Please don't speak too loudly. Or make too much eye contact.
I love it.
All right. Well, on that note, folks, be waiting to hear from Introvert Con 2014. So ending this podcast, we want to do our part for kind of community building. We've been in touch, and we're going to be doing a lot more coordinating with the Strangers and Aliens podcast, another sort of Christian geek podcast.
Yeah, they're a lot of fun. I've been behind because of
Easter
and horrible stomach plagues of death.
It's very true.
So I'm a little behind on my internet world.
But expect to see sort of more of that, you know, as we try to see what happens with Geekfully Yoked and where we take it, and you know, once we're popular in Denmark and Scandinavia, you know, we'll see where things go.
And not just with our friend Tom?
Well, he's certainly a niche audience.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, Tom. Well, from the world of faith, family, and fandom, in no particular order, we wish you all a wonderful week.
And I will go back to sitting under my blanket with my head in my hood.
Geek out, y'all. Wanna Ryan a Roaisha in Vulcan and Klingon it's Kapha, which sort of sounds like a threat. Aijalau is Romulan, but not exactly canon, in case we make the fanboys upset. Nikar Tele Gardaras is Mandalorian in another.